Continued, Cassette 5, Side 1. In the East, however, there has never been much philosophical or religious, only in the West are these two separate, confusion about matter and energy. The world of matter is a relative world, and an illusory one. Illusory not in the sense that it does not exist, but illusory in the sense that we do not see it as it really is. The way it really is cannot be communicated verbally, but in the attempt to talk around it, Eastern literature speaks repeatedly of dancing energy and transient, impermanent forms. This is strikingly similar to the picture of physical reality emerging from high-energy particle physics. Buddhist literature does not speak of learning new things about reality, but about removing veils of ignorance that stand between us and what we already are. Perhaps this accounts for the fact that the preposterous claim that mass is only a form of energy is unexpectedly palatable. The formula which expresses the relationship of mass to energy is the most famous formula in the world, E equals mc squared. The energy contained in a piece of matter is equal to the mass of the matter multiplied by an extraordinarily large number, the speed of light squared. This means that even the tiniest, the very tiniest particle of matter has within it a tremendous amount of concentrated energy. Although Einstein didn't know it at the time, he discovered the secret of stellar energy. Stars continuously convert matter into energy. It is because of the very large ratio of energy released to matter consumed that stars can continue to burn through countless millennia. At the center of a star, hydrogen atoms, the primordial stuff of the physical world, are squeezed together so tightly by the enormous gravitational force of the star's dense mass that they fuse together, making a new element, helium. Every 4 hydrogen atoms become 1 helium atom. However, the mass of 1 helium atom is not the same as the mass of 4 hydrogen atoms. It is slightly less. This small difference in mass is released as radiant energy, heat and light. The process of fusing lighter elements into heavier elements is called, of course, fusion. The fusion of hydrogen into helium causes a hydrogen explosion. In other words, a young, burning star is one huge, continuously exploding hydrogen bomb. The formula E equals mc squared also resulted in the atomic bomb. Atomic bombs and atomic reactors obtain energy from mass by the process of fission, which is the opposite of fusion. Instead of fusing smaller atoms into larger ones, the process of fission splits atoms of uranium, which are quite large, into atoms which are smaller. This is done by firing a subatomic particle, a neutron, at an atom of uranium. When the neutron hits the uranium atom, it splits into lighter atoms, but the mass of these smaller atoms together is less than the mass of the parent atom of uranium. The difference in mass explodes into energy. This process also produces additional neutrons which fly off to strike other uranium atoms, creating more fissions, more light atoms, more energy, and more neutrons. The whole phenomenon is called a chain reaction. An atomic bomb is an uncontrolled chain reaction. A hydrogen fusion bomb is produced by detonating an atomic fission bomb in the midst of hydrogen. The heat from the atomic explosion, in place of the heat of friction caused by gravity, fuses hydrogen atoms into helium atoms and releases heat in the process, which fuses together more hydrogen atoms, releasing more heat, and so on. There is no limit to the size of a potential hydrogen bomb, and it is constructed from the most plentiful element in the universe. For better or worse, a major revelation of the special theory of relativity is that mass and energy are different forms of the same thing. Like space and time, they are not separate entities. There is no qualitative difference between mass and energy. There is only mass-energy, hyphenated. Mathematically, this discovery meant that the 2 conservation laws of mass and energy could be replaced by a single conservation law of mass energy. A conservation law is a simple statement that a quantity of something, whatever it may be, never changes, no matter what happens. For example, suppose that there were a conservation law governing the number of guests at a party. If such a thing were true, we would notice that every time a new guest arrived at the party, some other guest would leave. Similarly, every time a guest at the party left, another one would arrive. The rate of guest turnover at the party might be great or small, and the guests might arrive and depart singly or in groups, but in all circumstances, the number of guests at the party would remain the same. The conservation law concerning energy says that the total amount of energy in the universe always has been and always will be the same. We can convert energy from one form to another, like mechanical energy to thermal energy via friction, but the total amount of energy in the universe does not change. Similarly, the law of conservation of matter says that the total amount of matter in the universe always has been and always will be the same. We can convert matter from one form to another, like ice to water or water to steam, but the total amount of matter in the universe does not change. When the special theory of relativity combined mass and energy into mass energy, it also combined the law of the conservation of mass and the law of the conservation of energy into the law of the conservation of mass energy. The law of the conservation of mass energy says that the total amount of mass energy in the universe always has been and always will be the same. Mass may be converted into energy, and energy may be converted into mass, but the total amount of mass energy in the universe does not change. The sun, the stars, even wood burning in the fireplace are examples of mass being converted into energy. Physicists who study subatomic particles are so familiar with the concept of exchanging mass for energy and energy for mass that they routinely designate the mass size of particles in terms of their energy content. In all, there are roughly 12 conservation laws. These simple laws are becoming more and more important, especially in high-energy particle physics, because they are derived from what physicists now believe to be the ultimate principles, latest dance, governing the physical world. These are the laws of symmetry. The laws of symmetry are pretty much what they sound like. Something is symmetrical if certain aspects of it remain the same under varying conditions. For example, one half of a circle mirrors the other half, no matter how we cut it. Regardless of how we turn a circle, the right half always mirrors the left half. The position of the circle changes, but its symmetry remains. The Chinese have a similar concept, perhaps the same. One side of a circle is called yin, and the other side is called yang. There is yin, there is yang. Where there is high, there is also low. Where there is day, there also is night. Where there is death, there also is birth. The concept of yin-yang, which is really a very old law of symmetry, is yet another way of saying that the physical universe is a whole which seeks balance within itself. The irony of the special theory of relativity, as apparent by now, is that it is not about those aspects of reality that are relative, but about those aspects that are not relative. Like quantum mechanics, its impact on the assumptions of Newtonian physics was shattering, not because it proved them wrong, but because it proved them to be quite limited. The special theory of relativity and quantum mechanics have propelled us into unimaginably expansive areas of reality, areas about which we literally had not one previous idea. The assumptions of Newtonian physics correspond to the clothes we always thought that the emperor was wearing, a universal time whose uniform passage equally affects every part of the universe, a separate space, independent though empty, and the belief that there exists somewhere in the universe a place which stands absolutely still, quiet, and unmoving. Every one of these assumptions has been proven untrue, not useful, by the special theory of relativity. The emperor wasn't wearing them at all. The only motion in the physical universe is motion relative to something else. There is no separate space and time. Mass and energy are different names for the same thing. In place of these assumptions, the special theory of relativity provides a new and unified physics. Measurements of distance and duration may vary from one frame of reference to another, but the space-time interval between events never changes. For all this, however, the special theory of relativity has one shortcoming. It is based on a rather uncommon situation. The special theory of relativity applies only to frames of reference that move uniformly, relative to each other. Most movement, unfortunately, is neither constant nor ideally smooth. In other words, the special theory of relativity is built upon an idealization. It is limited to and premised upon the special situation of uniform motion. That is why Einstein called it the special or restricted theory. Einstein's vision was to construct a physics that is valid for all frames of reference, such as those moving with non-uniform motion, acceleration and deceleration, relative to each other, as well as those moving uniformly relative to each other. His idea was to create a physics which could describe events in terms of any frame of reference, no matter how it moves relative to any other frame of reference. In 1915, Einstein succeeded in achieving the complete generalization of his special theory. He called this achievement the general theory of relativity. Chapter 1. General Nonsense. The general theory of relativity shows us that our minds follow different rules than the real world does. A rational mind, based on the impressions that it receives from its limited perspective, forms structures which thereafter determine what it further will and will not accept freely. From that point on, regardless of how the real world actually operates, this rational mind, following its self-imposed rules, tries to superimpose on the real world its own version of what must be. This continues until at long last a beginner's mind cries out, "This is not right. What must be is not happening. I have tried and tried to discover why this is so. I have stretched my imagination to the limit to preserve my belief in what must be. The breaking point has come. Now I have no choice but to admit that the must I have believed in does not come from the real world, but from my own head." This narrative is not poetic hyperbole. It is a concise description of the major conclusion of the general theory of relativity and the means by which it was reached. The limited perspective is the perspective of our three-dimensional rationality and its view of one small part of the universe, the part into which we were born. The things that must be are the ideas of geometry, the rules governing straight lines, circles, triangles, etc. The beginner's mind was Albert Einstein's. The long-held belief was that these rules govern, without exception, the entirety of the universe. What Einstein's beginner's mind realized was that this is so only in our minds. Einstein discovered that certain laws of geometry are valid only in limited regions of space. This makes them useful since our experience physically is limited to very small regions of space, like our solar system. However, as our experience expands, we encounter more and more difficulty in trying to superimpose these rules upon the entire expanse of the universe. Einstein was the first person to see that the geometrical rules which apply to one small part of the universe as seen from a limited perspective, like ours, are not universal. This freed him to behold the universe in a way that no person had seen it before. What he saw is the content of the general theory of relativity. Einstein did not set out to prove anything about the nature of our minds. His interest was in physics. "Our new idea," he wrote, "is simple, to build a physics valid for all coordinate systems." The fact that he did illustrate something of importance about the way that we structure our perceptions is indicative of an inevitable trend toward the merger of physics and psychology. How did Einstein get from a theory of physics to a revolutionary statement of geometry? How did that lead to a significant insight into our mental processes? The answer to these questions is one of the least known, but one of the most important and intriguing intellectual adventures recorded. Einstein started with his special theory of relativity. As successful as it was, Einstein was not satisfied with it because it applied only to coordinate systems moving uniformly relative to each other. "Is it possible," thought Einstein, "to explain the same phenomenon as seen from two different frames of reference? one of them moving uniformly and the other of them moving non-uniformly, in such a way that there is a consistent explanation for the phenomenon in terms of both the uniformly moving frame of reference and the non-uniformly moving frame of reference. In other words, can we describe events which happen in a coordinate system which is moving non-uniformly in terms which are meaningful to an observer in a coordinate system which is moving uniformly, and the other way round? Can we create one physics that is valid for observers in both frames of reference? Yes, discovered Einstein, it is possible for observers in the two different frames of reference to relate in a manner which is both meaningful in terms of their own state of motion and in terms of the other's state of motion. To illustrate this, he used another famous thought experiment. Imagine an elevator in an extraordinarily tall building. The cable which supports the elevator has snapped, and the elevator is plummeting downward. Inside the elevator are several physicists. They are not aware that the cable is broken, and since there are no windows, they cannot look outside. The question is, what is the appraisal of this situation by the observers on the outside of the elevator, us, and by the observers on the inside of the elevator, the physicists? Since this is an idealized experiment, we can disregard the effects of friction and the resistance of the air. To us, the situation is apparent. The elevator is falling, and soon it will strike the earth and all of its inhabitants will be dead. As the elevator falls, it accelerates according to Newton's law of gravity. The motion of the elevator is not uniform, but accelerated, because of the gravitational field of the earth. We can predict many things that might happen inside the elevator. For example, if someone inside the elevator dropped a handkerchief, nothing would happen. It would appear to the inside observers to float where it was released, because it would be accelerating toward the earth at the same rate as the elevator and the people inside of it. Nothing really would be floating, everything would be falling, but since everything would be falling at the same rate, there would be no change in their relative positions. To a generation of physicists born and brought up inside the elevator, however, things would appear quite differently. To them, dropped objects do not fall, they simply hang in midair. If someone gives a floating object a shove, off it goes in a straight line until it hits the side of the elevator. To the observers inside the elevator, there are no forces acting on any objects inside the elevator. In short, the observers inside the elevator would conclude that they are in an inertial coordinate system. The laws of mechanics are perfectly valid. Their experiments always produce results which agree exactly with theoretical predictions. An object at rest remains at rest. An object in motion remains in motion. Moving objects are deflected from their paths only by forces which are proportional to the amount of deflection. For every reaction, there is an equal and opposite reaction. If we give a shove to a floating chair, it goes off in one direction, and we go off in the opposite direction with an equal momentum, although with a slower speed because of our greater mass. The inside observers have a consistent explanation for the phenomena inside the elevator. They are in an inertial coordinate system, and they can prove it by the laws of mechanics. The outside observers also have a consistent explanation for the phenomena inside the elevator. The elevator is falling in a gravitational field. Its passengers are unaware of this because, without being able to see outside the elevator, there is no way for them to detect it while they are falling. Their coordinate system is in accelerated motion, even though they believe that it is not moving at all. The bridge between these two explanations is gravity. The falling elevator is a pocket edition of an inertial coordinate system. A real inertial coordinate system is not limited in space or time. The elevator edition is limited in both. It is limited in space because a moving object inside the elevator will not move in a straight line forever, but only until it reaches one of the walls of the elevator. It is limited in time because sooner or later the elevator and its passengers are going to collide with the earth, ending their existence abruptly. According to the special theory of relativity, moreover, it is significant that the elevator is limited in size because otherwise it would not appear to its inhabitants as an inertial coordinate system. For example, if the physicists inside the elevator simultaneously drop two baseballs, the baseballs float in the air exactly where they are released and remain there. This, to the outside observer, is because they are falling parallel to each other. However, if the elevator were the size of Texas and the baseballs were as far apart when they were dropped as Texas is wide, the baseballs would not fall parallel to each other. They would converge, since each of them would be drawn by gravity to the center of the Earth. The observers inside the elevator would notice that the baseballs and any other floating objects in the elevator were moving toward each other with the passage of time, as though there were a mutual attraction between them. This mutual attraction would appear as a force affecting the objects in the elevator, and the physicists inside hardly would conclude under those circumstances that they were in an inertial coordinate system. In short, if it is small enough, a coordinate system falling in a gravitational field is the equivalent of an inertial coordinate system. This is Einstein's principle of equivalence. It is a telling piece of mental dexterity. Anything like an inertial coordinate system that can be wiped out, Einstein's words, by the assumption of a gravitational field hardly deserves to be called absolute, as in absolute motion and absolute non-motion. While the observers inside the elevator experience a lack of motion and the absence of gravity, the observers outside the elevator see a coordinate system, the elevator, accelerating through a gravitational field. Now, let us imagine a variation of this situation. Assume that we, the outside observers, are in an inertial coordinate system. We already know what happens in inertial coordinate systems, the same things that happen in the falling elevator. There are no forces, including gravity, to affect us. Therefore, let us assume that we are comfortably floating. Objects at rest remain at rest. Objects in motion continue in a straight line forever, and every action produces an equal and opposite reaction. In our inertial coordinate system is an elevator. Someone has attached a rope to the elevator and is pulling it across our vision, diagonally and upward, from lower left to upper right. Since this is a thought experiment, it does not matter how this is done. The elevator is being pulled with a constant force, which means that it is in a state of constant acceleration. How will observers outside the elevator and observers inside the elevator appraise this situation? As we float outside the elevator, we experience that our frame of reference is absolutely at rest and that there is no gravity affecting it. We see the elevator being pulled with a constant acceleration by the rope, and so we can predict certain things about it. Everything inside the elevator that is not attached quickly collides with the floor of the elevator. If someone in the elevator drops a handkerchief, the elevator floor rushes up to meet it. If someone in the elevator tries to jump off the floor, rushing upward, is instantly under his feet again. The floor of the elevator continually crashes into anything in its path as it accelerates upward. Inside the elevator, however, the appraisal of the situation is quite different. To a generation of physicists born and brought up inside the elevator, talk of acceleration upward is fantasy. Remember, the elevator has no windows. To them, their coordinate system is quite at rest. Objects fall downward to the floor because of a gravitational field, just as objects on the Earth fall downward to the floor because of a gravitational field. Both the observers inside the elevator and the observers outside the elevator have consistent explanations for the phenomena inside the elevator. We observers outside the elevator explain them by the accelerated motion of the elevator. The observers inside the elevator explain them by the presence of a gravitational field. There is absolutely no way to determine which of us is right. Wait a minute, we say. Suppose that we cut a small hole in one wall of the elevator and shine a light beam through it. If the elevator really were motionless, the light beam would strike the opposite wall of the elevator at a spot exactly opposite the hole. Since we can see that the elevator is accelerating upward, we know that the elevator wall will move upward slightly in the time it takes the light beam to cross the elevator. Therefore, the light beam will strike the far wall slightly below the spot just opposite the hole it entered through. In effect, it will seem to curve downward from the point of view of the people inside the elevator instead of traveling in a straight line. This should prove to them that their elevator is in motion. It does not prove anything of the sort, says Jim DeWitt, who, of course, is inside the elevator. The light beams in this elevator do not travel in straight lines. How could they? We are in a gravitational field. Light is energy, and energy has mass. Gravity attracts mass, and a light beam traveling through our elevator will be drawn downward by our gravitational field, exactly like a baseball thrown horizontally at the speed of light. There is no way that we can convince DeWitt that his coordinate system is in a state of accelerated motion. Everything that we can say to prove this to him, he dismisses, accounts for, as a result of his gravitational field. There is absolutely no way of distinguishing between uniform accelerated motion and a constant gravitational field. This is another expression of Einstein's principle of equivalence. In limited areas, gravity is equivalent to acceleration. We already saw that acceleration, falling through a gravitational field, is the equivalent of an inertial coordinate system. Now we see that a gravitational field is equivalent to accelerated motion. At last, we are approaching a general theory of relativity, a theory valid for all frames of reference regardless of their states of motion. The bridge which links the explanations of the observers inside of the elevator and the explanations of the observers outside of the elevator is gravity, the clue which indicated to Einstein that gravity was the key to his general theory, was as old as physics itself. There are two kinds of mass, which means that there are two ways of talking about it. The first is gravitational mass. The gravitational mass of an object, roughly speaking, is the weight of the object as measured on a balance scale. Something that weighs three times more than another object has three times more mass. Gravitational mass is the measure of how much force the gravity of the Earth exerts on an object. Newton's laws describe the effects of this force, which vary with the distance of the mass from the Earth. Although Newton's laws describe the effects of this force, they do not define it. This is the mystery of action at a distance. How does the Earth invisibly reach up and pull objects downward? The second type of mass is inertial mass. Inertial mass is the measure of the resistance of an object to acceleration, or deceleration, which is negative acceleration. For example, it takes three times more force to move three railroad cars from a standstill to 20 miles per hour, positive acceleration, than it takes to move one railroad car from a standstill to 20 miles per hour. Similarly, once they are moving, it takes three times more force to stop three cars than it takes to stop the single car. This is because the inertial mass of the three railroad cars is three times more than the inertial mass of the single railroad car. Inertial mass and gravitational mass are equal. This explains why a feather and a cannonball fall with equal velocity in a vacuum. The cannonball has hundreds of times more gravitational mass than the feather. It weighs more. But it also has hundreds of times more resistance to motion than the feather, its inertial mass. Its attraction to the Earth is hundreds of times stronger than that of the feather, but then so is its inclination not to move. The result is that it accelerates downward at the same rate as the feather, although it seems that it should fall much faster. The fact that inertial mass and gravitational mass are equal was known 300 years ago, but physicists considered it a coincidence. No significance was attached to it until Einstein published his general theory of relativity. The coincidence of the equivalence of gravitational mass and inertial mass was the clue, C-L-E-W, to use Einstein's word, that led him to the principle of equivalence, which refers via the equivalence of gravitational mass and inertial mass to the equivalence of gravity and acceleration themselves. These are the things that he illustrated with his famous elevator examples. The special theory of relativity deals with unaccelerated, uniform motion. If acceleration is neglected, the special theory of relativity applies. However, since gravity and acceleration are equivalent, this is the same as saying that the special theory of relativity is applicable whenever gravity is neglected. If the effects of gravity are to be considered, then we must use the general theory of relativity. In the physical world, the effects of gravity can be neglected in 1. Remote regions of space, which are far from any centers of gravity, matter, and 2. In very small regions of space. Why gravity can be ignored in very small regions of space leads to the most psychedelic aspect of all Einstein's theories. Gravity can be ignored in very small regions of space because, if the region is small enough, the mountainous terrain of space-time is not noticeable. The nature of the space-time continuum is like that of a hilly countryside. The hills are caused by pieces of matter, objects. The larger the piece of matter, the more it curves the space-time continuum. In remote regions of space, far from any matter of significant size, the space-time continuum resembles a flat plane. A piece of matter the size of the Earth causes quite a bump in the space-time continuum, and a piece of matter the size of a star causes a relative mountain. As an object travels through the space-time continuum, it takes the easiest path between two points. The easiest path between two points in the space-time continuum is called a geodesic. A geodesic is not always a straight line, owing to the nature of the terrain in which the object finds itself. Suppose that we are in a balloon looking down on a mountain that has a bright beacon on the top of it. The mountain rises gradually out of the plain and becomes more and more steep as its elevation increases, until close to the top it rises almost straight up. There are many villages surrounding the mountain, and there are footpaths connecting all of the villages with each other. As the paths approach the mountain, all of them begin to curve in one way or another to avoid going unnecessarily far up the mountain. Suppose that it is nighttime and that looking down, we can see neither the mountain nor the footpaths. All that we can see is the beacon and the torches of the travelers below. As we watch, we notice that the torches deflect from a straight path when they approach the vicinity of the beacon. Some of them curve gently around the beacon in a graceful arc some distance away from it. Others approach the beacon more directly, but the closer they get to it, the more sharply they turn away from it. From this, we probably would deduce that some force emanating from the beacon was repelling all attempts to approach it. For example, we might speculate that the beacon is extremely hot and painful to approach. With the coming of daylight, however, we can see that the beacon is situated on the top of a large mountain, and that it has nothing whatever to do with the movement of the torchbearers. They simply followed the easiest paths available to them over the terrain between their points of origin and destination. This masterful analogy was created by Bertrand Russell. In this case, the mountain is the sun, the travelers are the planets, asteroids, comets, and debris from the space program, the footpaths are their orbits, and the coming of daylight is the coming of Einstein's general theory of relativity. The point is that the objects in the solar system move as they do, not because of some mysterious force, gravity, exerted upon them at a distance by the sun, but because of the nature of the neighborhood through which they are traveling. Arthur Eddington illustrated this same situation in another way. Suppose, he suggested, that we are in a boat looking down into clear water. We can see the sand on the bottom and the fishes swimming beneath us. As we watch, we notice that the fish seem to be repelled from a certain point. As they approach it, they swim either to the right or to the left of it, but never over it. From this, we probably would deduce that there is a repellent force at that point which keeps the fish away. However, if we should go into the water to get a closer look, we would see that an enormous sunfish has buried himself in the sand at that point, creating a sizable mound. As fish swimming along the bottom approach the mound, they follow the easiest path available to them, which is around it rather than over it. There is no force causing the fish to avoid that particular spot. If all had been known from the first, that spot was merely the top of a large mound, which the fish found easier to swim around than to swim over. The movement of the fish was determined not by a force emanating from a mysterious spot, but by the nature of the neighborhood through which they were passing. Eddington's sunfish was called Albert, really. If we could see the geography, the geometry, of the space-time continuum, we would see that similarly it, and not forces between objects, is the reason that planets move in the ways that they do. It is not possible for us to actually see the geometry of the space-time continuum because it is four-dimensional, and our sensory experience is limited to three dimensions. For that reason, it is not even possible to picture it. For example, suppose that there existed a world of two-dimensional people. Such a world would look like a picture on a television or a movie screen. The people and the objects in a two-dimensional world would have height and width, but not depth. If these two-dimensional figures had a life and an intelligence of their own, their world would appear quite different to them than our world appears to us, for they could not experience the third dimension. A straight line drawn between two of these people would appear to them as a wall. They would be able to walk around either end of it, but they would not be able to step over it because their physical existence is limited to two dimensions. They cannot step off the screen into the third dimension. They would know what a circle is, but there is no way that they could know what a sphere is. In fact, a sphere would appear to them as a circle. If they like to explore, they soon would discover that their world is flat and infinite. If two of them went off in opposite directions, they would never meet. They also could create a simple geometry. Sooner or later, they would generalize their experiences into abstractions to help them do and build the things that they want to do and build in their physical world. For example, they would discover that whenever three straight metal bars form a triangle, the angles of the triangle always total 180 degrees. Sooner or later, the more perceptive among them would substitute mental idealizations, straight lines, for the metal bars. That would allow them to arrive at the abstract conclusion that a triangle, which by definition is formed by three straight lines, always contains 180 degrees. To learn more about triangles, they no longer would need actually to construct them. The geometry that such a two-dimensional people would create is the same geometry that we studied in school. It is called Euclidean geometry, in honor of the Greek Euclid, whose thoughts on the subject were so thorough that no one expanded on them for nearly 2,000 years. The content of most high school geometry books is about 2 millennia old. Now, let us suppose that someone, unbeknownst to them, transported these two-dimensional people from their flat world onto the surface of an enormously large sphere. This means that instead of being perfectly flat, their physical world now would be somewhat curved. At first, no one would notice the difference. However, if their technology improved enough to allow them to begin to travel and to communicate over great distances, these people eventually would make a remarkable discovery. They would discover that their geometry could not be verified in their physical world. For example, they would discover that if they surveyed a large enough triangle and measured the angles that form it, it would have more than 180 degrees. This is a simple phenomenon for us to picture. Imagine a triangle drawn on a globe. The apex, top of the triangle, is at the North Pole. The two lines intersecting there form a right angle. The equator is the base of the triangle. Look what happens. Both sides of the triangle, upon intersecting the equator, also form right angles. According to Euclidean geometry, a triangle contains only two right angles, 180 degrees. Yet this triangle contains three right angles, 270 degrees. Remember that in our example, the two-dimensional people actually have surveyed a triangle on what they presumed was their flat world, measured the angles, and come up with 270 degrees. What a confusion! When the dust settles, they would realize that there are only two possible explanations. The first possible explanation is that the straight lines used to construct the triangle, like light beams, were not actually straight, although they seemed to be straight. This could account for the excessive number of degrees in the triangle. However, if this is the explanation that they choose to adopt, then they must create a force responsible for somehow distorting the straight lines, like gravity. The second possible explanation is that their abstract geometry does not apply to their real world. This is another way of saying that, impossible as it sounds, their universe is not Euclidean. The idea that their physical reality is not Euclidean probably would sound so fantastic to them, especially if they had had no reason to question the reality of Euclidean geometry for 2,000 years, that they probably would choose to look for forces responsible for distorting their straight lines. The problem is that, having chosen this course, they would be obligated to create a responsible force every time that their physical world failed to validate Euclidean geometry. Eventually, the structure of these necessary forces would become so complex that it would be much simpler to forget them altogether and admit that their physical world does not follow the logically irrefutable rules of Euclidean geometry. Our situation is parallel to that of the two-dimensional people who cannot perceive, but who can deduce that they are living in a three-dimensional world. We are a three-dimensional people who cannot perceive, but who can deduce that we are living in a four-dimensional universe. For 2,000 years, we have assumed that the entire physical universe, like the geometry that the ancient Greeks created from their experience with this part of it, was Euclidean. That the geometry of Euclid is universally valid means that it can be verified anywhere in the physical world. That assumption was wrong. Einstein was the first person to see that the universe is not bound by the rules of Euclidean geometry, even though our minds tenaciously cling to the idea that it is. Although we cannot perceive the four-dimensional space-time continuum directly, we can deduce from what we already know of the special theory of relativity that our universe is not Euclidean. Here is another of Einstein's thought experiments. Imagine two concentric circles, one with a small radius and one with a very large radius. Both of them revolve around a common center. Imagine also that we, the observers, are watching these revolving circles from an inertial coordinate system. Being in an inertial coordinate system simply means that our frame of reference is at rest relative to everything, including the revolving circles. Drawn over the revolving circles are two identical concentric circles which are in our coordinate system. They are not revolving. They are the same size as the revolving circles and have the same common center, but they remain motionless. While we and our non-revolving circles are motionless, we are in communication with an observer who is on the revolving circles. He is actually going around with them. According to Euclidean geometry, the ratio of the radius to the circumference of all circles is the same. If we measure the radius and the circumference of the small circle, for example, the ratio of these two measurements will be the same as the ratio of the radius to the circumference of the large circle. The object of this thought experiment is to determine whether this is true or not for both the observers on the stationary circles, us, and the observer on the revolving circles. If the geometry of Euclid is valid throughout the physical universe, as it should be, we should discover that the ratio between the radius and the circumference of all the circles involved is identical. Both we and the observer on the revolving circles will use the same ruler to do our measuring. The same ruler means that either we actually hand him the same ruler that we have used, or that we use rulers that have the same length when at rest in the same coordinate system. We go first. Using our ruler, we measure the radius of our small circle, and then we measure the circumference of our small circle. Then we note the ratio between them. The next step is to measure the radius of our large circle and then the circumference of our large circle. Then we note the ratio between them. Yes, it is the same ratio that we found between the radius and the circumference of our small circle. We have proved that Euclidean geometry is valid in our coordinate system, which is an inertial coordinate system. Now we hand the ruler to the observer on the revolving circles as he passes by us. Using this ruler, he first measures the radius of his small circle and finds that it is the same as ours, since our circles are drawn directly over his circles. Next, he measures the circumference of his small circle. Remember that motion causes rulers to contract in the direction that they are moving. However, since the radius of the small circle is so short, the velocity of the ruler when it is placed on the circumference of the small circle is not fast enough to make the effect of relativistic contraction noticeable. Therefore, the observer on the revolving circles measures the circumference of his small circle and finds it to be the same as the circumference of our small circle. Naturally, the ratio between them is also the same. So far, so good. The ratios between the radius and the circumference of three circles have been determined: our small circle, our large circle, and his small circle. And they all are identical. This is exactly what should happen according to high school geometry books across the country. Only one more circle to go. The observer on the revolving circles measures the radius of his large circle and finds it to be the same length as the radius of our large circle. Now he comes to the last measurement, the circumference of his large circle. However, as soon as he puts his ruler into position to make a measurement on the circumference of the large revolving circle, his ruler contracts. Because the radius of his large circle is much larger than the radius of his small circle, the velocity of the circumference of the large revolving circle is considerably faster than the velocity of the circumference of the small revolving circle. Since the ruler must be aligned in the direction that the circumference is moving, it becomes shorter. When the revolving observer uses this ruler to measure the circumference of the large revolving circle, he finds that it is larger than the circumference of our large circle. This is because his ruler is shorter. Contraction also affected his ruler when he measured the radius of his large circle, but since it then was placed perpendicular to the direction of motion, it became skinnier, not shorter. This means that the ratio of the radius to the circumference of the small revolving circle is not the same as the ratio of the radius to the circumference of the large revolving circle. According to Euclidean geometry, this is not possible, but there it is. If we want to be old-fashioned about it, before Einstein, we can say that this situation is nothing unusual. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.